A trip to, let's call it, Wonkistan.
We now have resourced properly this strategy. It's not going to be an open-ended commitment of infinite resources. We've just got to make sure that we are focused.
Focused, resourced, and efforting a positive upside for the American people. Obama's policy for Afghanistan, Pakistan, and South Asia gets a global look. Mulling over the mission, getting beyond Al-Qaeda, or not, on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Monday, March 30th. Adora Udoji is away spending time with her new baby. And coming up this hour, we've got the Takeaway Agenda, your preview of all the big events in a crowded week to come. We're going to revisit North Dakota. Last week, we met some of the ordinary people packing sandbags to save their town. What are they doing this morning? It's very, very cold in Fargo. Those stories and more coming up. First, the top headlines. President Obama says time's up, and GM and Chrysler have failed to make their case for more bailout money. But the president still thinks the industry can come up with a plan.
It's got to be one that's realistically designed to weather this storm and to emerge at the other end much more lean, mean, and competitive than it currently is.
In the category of lean, CEO Rick Wagoner is apparently out. He stepped down yesterday. This buys the new leadership at General Motors another 60 days to get things in order. Excuse me. Over at Chrysler, the leadership stays, but the White House says that company needs to get more global. Chrysler has 30 days to complete an alliance with Italian carmaker Fiat. Bankruptcy for either company is apparently still an option. Mark Garrison, what else we got?
Good morning, John. First, let's start with two stories overseas. In the northeastern Pakistani city of Lahore, paramilitary troops are celebrating the end of a 9-hour siege at a police academy. The number of dead is still being verified. At least 4 militants were killed and many more were arrested. And in Cambodia, the first trial has started at a special tribunal into atrocities committed during the Khmer Rouge era. A former prison chief known as Comrade Duik faces charges of crimes against humanity for his alleged role in the deaths of more than 10,000 people at the prison. Here in the U.S., officials in Carthage, North Carolina, are still trying to figure out why Robert Stewart opened fire at a nursing home yesterday. Police say he killed 7 patients and a nurse and wounded 3 others. Officials say Stewart's ex-wife worked at the home. The weekend flooding in Fargo, North Dakota, wasn't quite as bad as feared, but the Red River is still more than 20 feet over flood stage, and a winter storm is expected to drop up to 0.5 foot of snow and bring bone-chilling 40-mile-an-hour winds today.
Although the snow is positive.
It's not cold enough for it to melt into water, right. But the worry is the wind will kind of whip some of the water over the levee. So that's what we're looking at.
It's miserable, but it doesn't raise the waters anymore. So markets are volatile this morning. Asian stock markets took a nosedive today. Japan's Nikkei and Hong Kong's Hang Seng were both down more than 4.5%. Europe's key indices down 2-3%. And Wall Street futures are looking negative when the opening happens at about 90 minutes from now. GM's Rick Wagoner is stepping down as head of the troubled company. It's time for a job interview. If you had the job, how would you save GM? So what would you invest in? What would you shutter? Mark, you want the job?
I don't.
Our listeners actually do. They're calling in at 877-8-MY-TAKE and MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org to do a job interview. Head of GM? Why not?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. It's Monday. Time to take a look forward through this busy week. Dylan?
Hey, what's up, man?
Our government.
Bailout.
Your government.
Energy resources.
Healthcare.
Iraq and Afghanistan.
Global financial recession.
The work that needs to be done.
What's going on, indeed? The agenda this week is a crowded mix of domestic economics, complicated foreign policy, and a meeting of the richest nations on the planet that may turn out to be as much of a political bullseye for them as a productive strategy session on what's to happen in the global economy. Joining us are James Surowiecki, business columnist for The New Yorker from Washington. James, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
And Marcus Mabry, our pal and international business editor at our partner, The New York Times. Marcus, thanks for being with you.
Good morning.
Sort of Marcus Mabry Monday, I think. I love the alliteration.
Triple
there.
M, yeah.
So we begin with anybody want the GM job? Rick Wagoner is out. Obama announced, well, doesn't really announce it, but apparently it was a condition of rolling out the auto restructuring plan. But here's the president on Face the Nation yesterday.
Everybody's having problems, even Toyota and other very profitable companies. And so what we're trying to let them know is that we want to have a successful auto industry, U.S. auto industry. We think we can have a successful U.S. auto industry, but it's got to be one that's realistically designed to weather this storm and to emerge at the other end much more lean, mean, and competitive than it currently is.
So, James Surowiecki, I love your column in The New Yorker because it always has a sort of a different view of stuff that's in the headlines, economically speaking. I'm wondering if we can test those assumptions here this morning. Do we really need to have a successful auto industry? Is this more a jobs program for the people of Detroit? And if Barack Obama really wants a sort of energy-efficient car industry to exist, are these the guys to do it? James?
Well, I actually think my counterintuitive take would be counterintuitive to yours in the sense that I actually think that I would like the United States to have a successful auto industry, and I actually think it is important from a jobs perspective, particularly right now. But, you know, Obama has effectively, I think, decided that the auto industry, as it's currently constituted, can't really go on because the important thing that happened is not just that Wagner was fired, but that essentially, I think today, this morning around 11, Obama is going to announce that they basically are giving GM 60 days and then probably going to put them into bankruptcy. So they basically have kind of called an end to the bailouts, or at least to the open-ended bailouts. So, you know, it sounds to me like what the Obama administration has decided is that actually, in some ways, I don't know if your particular take is exactly right, but that the way the auto industry exists right now, just it isn't really in a position to kind of deal with, you know, the new future, or for that matter, even the present.
See, I'm the host of the show, James. It's just a question to me. I have no take, baby. I have no take. So, Marcus Mabry, you know, I was talking with a lawyer last night who was very involved in the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy, essentially the dissolution of Lehman Brothers. And if GM goes into the bankruptcy court, it's not going to be any bloodier and crazier than that. So in some sense, if James is right, the government is sort of ready for a GM bankruptcy. It's not as bad as maybe we all think.
Well, you know, two things. The argument always was from GM's perspective. Number one, we can't go into bankruptcy because no one is going to buy a car. And Chrysler made the same argument. No one's going to buy a car from a company that's going bankrupt. So we can increase our sales in this horrible, dismal time if no one's going to buy our cars.
What we learned is nobody's going to buy a car, period.
Well, exactly. Anyway, so the government's now saying, you know what, we'll guarantee all the cars, all the GM cars, we'll guarantee them. We will help supervise a bankruptcy. It's going to be an orderly bankruptcy, nothing like the dissolution of Lehman, for instance. And so they're saying that they hope that that will be enough now to put on the spot the UAW and the bondholders for GM. They said, now that we've gotten Rick Wagner's head on the platter, now you guys have to make concessions if you expect, you know, this company to go on at all.
Marcus, what do you make of the Rick Wagner thing? Is this a way of insulating themselves from the AIG fallout? If you lead with the beheaded GM, suddenly you're not going to have some story of somebody getting a decent salary coming to you know, sort of blow up in their faces?
Well, you know, they had to do it, politically speaking. They had to be, management really had to make concessions, and this was the ultimate concession. And otherwise, there was a political problem out here, of people saying, well, you're rewarding the guys who've made these mistakes over decades and really hurt this company, and he's been in charge since 2000. But then secondly, they also needed to do it to bring this pressure on the bondholders and the UAW to say, look, we've extracted a pound of flesh from management. Now you guys have to give too.
James, the headline here really, I think, is Chrysler. It's fiat or nothing. Is that a careful read?
Yeah, that seems about right. It seems pretty clear that they're essentially just going to throw Chrysler to the wind, and if Fiat wants to catch it and keep it afloat, then it can, and if not, it sounds very much like Chrysler will go under. I mean, I actually been, from way back, I was a supporter of the bailout, and especially in the fall when the Bush administration did it, because especially at that time, I just thought in terms of the economy as a whole, it would just have been a massive trauma to the economy, essentially. And I think that some kind of stimulus package that included a bailout would have been a good idea, but Chrysler was always the one company that it made kind of dubious sense to do this for, both because it was in far more trouble, it was far less important from a jobs perspective, and it was owned by a private equity company where you thought, you know, these guys have, Cerberus has more than enough money to put into Chrysler if, in fact, they think it's viable, and there's no good reason for the taxpayers to be doing that. So that part of it especially, I think, is pretty unsurprising.
Well, after AIG, bailing out a private equity firm is probably not going to be viable. Friday, since it's the beginning of the month of April, we're going to get a look at unemployment numbers. You want to look ahead there, James?
Well, I don't think, obviously, this will not yet have an impact, but I expect the unemployment rate to be, you know, well above 8.5%, potentially even higher than that. But, you know, I think last couple weeks, we've seen not quite a deceleration. I mean, we've seen basically sort of a stabilization. I mean, every week it's around 650,000 new claims. So, you know, I think the numbers are just going to keep going up for overall employment. I don't think we're going to see good news on the employment front, probably for another 6 to 7 months, if then.
Well, we'll hold you to that.
Yeah.
Marcus Mabry, let's shift gears for a second. It was an extraordinary rollout of the Afghanistan-Pakistan policy when Barack Obama and his entire national security team faced reporters and gave this speech about what needs to happen now in Afghanistan, Pakistan, dealing with India. You know, Al-Qaeda was mentioned. Hamid Karzai was definitely not mentioned, the president of Afghanistan. Who was this a signal to? It seems to me, number one, it's a signal that the Rumsfeld era is ending and the president is running the show. Who's going to get that message, Marcus?
Well, you know, I think it was a signal to the NATO allies who are helping us in Afghanistan, as well as to our opponents in Afghanistan and to Al-Qaeda, which seems to be uniting its factions against us, knowing that we're going to be sending thousands more American troops there. I think, you know, we'll be seeing this week more talks about Afghanistan on the global stage. I think the administration wants to lay on its card, put its cards on the table for our allies to say, we're committed to this. We're committed to doing it, though, in a different way from our predecessors, and we're still committed to a form of success, a more narrow success perhaps, than what the Afghanistan policy had been before. And we are very aware of how steep this mountain is to climb.
And that discussion will begin tomorrow at The Hague. United Nations and NATO members are going to be talking about Afghanistan and what to do about the Taliban. But the big meeting, the big international meeting, James, and you refer to this in your piece in The New Yorker that's on the stands this week, is the G20 summit. And the difference between what it constitutes a stimulus package in Europe and what constitutes a stimulus package in the United States will very much be on the agenda there, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think that Europe and the United States have taken not completely different, but very, very different approaches to stimulus and have very different attitudes about what should be done right now and going forward. And I think if you expect a global stimulus package to come out of the G20, which is what I think Barack Obama would like, some kind of coherent approach to amping up the world economy in terms of governments committing to spending, I just don't think that's going to happen. The Europeans have been very clear they're not interested in spending much more money from a government perspective, and they actually have been much more cautious, as always, on interest rates. So they just have very different approaches, very different attitude, I think, toward economic growth, toward inflation, than we do.
Marcus Mabry, the meeting with the Queen, G20 leaders are going to be hanging out with the Queen as this meeting begins. Is that a good idea as protesters descend on London?
Well, you know, that's a purely ceremonial part, I think, of this meeting. I don't know.
But G may stand for guilty as far as the international community is concerned.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see. Look, I mean, this is going to be G20 week. This is going to be the big story of the week. You got American TV anchors who are heading over there to actually, you know, anchor from the G20. This has never happened before. It underscores the importance of what's happening. But also what we're going to see here is kind of Barack Obama's popularity. He's more popular than all his other G20 heads of state versus America. America's lack of popularity.
Something to watch. James Surowiecki, financial columnist for The New Yorker, and Marcus Mabry, international business editor for The New York Times, our partner. Thanks, guys.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So you take a turn behind the wheel, not of a Chevrolet, of General Motors. How would you save GM?
Hi, this is Beth Croft. I'm calling from Brookfield, Massachusetts. Basically, if I was the CEO of GM, I would take them into a bankruptcy-protected state. I would go ahead and upgrade their factories. Bottom line is we can't compete with the Japanese because of the fact that we can't change our factories over the way that they can. It takes us 18 months. It takes them about 18 hours.
Rick Wagner's out, but how would you steer GM if you were running the show? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Well, the Red River in Fargo, North Dakota, is way beyond its record quest. A 112-year-old record was broken on Friday morning when the river rose past 40.33 feet.
We are in uncharted territory. Nobody has ever seen the river at this level in the city of Fargo since the beginning of history.
Well, at the very beginning of history, during the Ice Age, Fargo was part of an inland sea underwater. So maybe part of that sea is returning, but it is cold and wet in the city of Fargo, North Dakota, this morning, where we find Sarah Mayo, student at North Dakota University. Sarah, good morning.
Good morning. Good to talk to you again.
Yes, it's nice to have you back. Dick Bailey's a Fargo resident and also a doctor there in the Fargo community. Dick Bailey, thanks for being with us.
Good morning to you.
And Courtney Johnson is in Fargo and is a spokesperson for the Red Cross. Courtney, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, Sarah, when we met you, there was a lot of anticipation last week that the community would be able to hold together and keep the water contained. It seems partially you've had some success there. How are you feeling about now?
Feeling pretty good. We've only lost a handful of houses within the city. Right now, though, kind of seems like everyone's just sort of sitting on their hands waiting to be told what to do. You know, waiting for another task because we had this outpouring of volunteering, and now it seems like there's nothing to do except wait until the water goes down.
Dick Bailey, would you rather be stacking sandbags right now than waiting to see if everything holds?
No, because if we were stacking sandbags, it would mean that there were a major problem on the dike. The dikes are all built. They're built up to 43 feet. And right now, everybody is just looking for leaks or cracks in the dikes, and so if we were stacking sandbags now, it would be because of a major developing problem.
Well, Courtney Johnson, you know, this sounds as though like just a real legacy of community involvement and, you know, people sort of hanging together. As we wait for the waters to go down, what are the long-term impacts in terms of health and housing on the community of Fargo?
You know, we have some disaster mental health volunteers with the American Red Cross, and they're able to kind of sit down with the people who are affected by this disaster and go through and talk to them about what they're experiencing, what's normal, and what the next steps are that they might be able to anticipate, and kind of work through them with the psychological aspects of this.
But is it safe to say that the worst has been avoided?
I wouldn't say so. You know, as far as the Red Cross is concerned, this is not a finished event. We're, just like everyone else in this town, is watching the levee very, very closely. This is still a very rapidly changing situation with the potential to turn around in a matter of minutes, literally, here, if something happens to one of the levees.
And that, of course, is because Fargo is so flat and, a street sign can be seen for miles. Dick Bailey, what are they telling you about the vulnerable areas in Fargo right now?
Well, the latest thing that happened was, the big thing was yesterday, that a place called Oak Grove School, which is right on the sort of the eastern edge of the downtown area, or just north of downtown, There was a breach in the dike, and quite a bit of area was flooded around this school. Since that time, there hasn't been any significant problem with the levee.
Now, Sarah Mayo, is cold weather a good thing?
Well, that's what they're telling us, because it prevents snow melt and we have less runoff water overland down into the river basin. Not really good when you're volunteering outside, but at least it's good for the overall situation.
So it's colder for the volunteers, but now I get it. It slows the snow melt, which is really the major problem of this watershed not being able to drain fast enough. When is the likelihood you'll actually go back to class, Sarah?
At this point, they have us down for April 6th, next Monday, and that's, of course, assuming that there's no major breaks and no major call for volunteers before that time.
You know, Sarah, you raised this issue last week that it's time for an update of that movie Fargo that a lot of people in your region maybe were offended by. I have to say the voices coming out of your community, Dick, have really, really changed, I think, the face forever of where and what this community is all about. Would you agree?
Well, I would hope so, because the people here are really wonderful, and we're very we're not. There's the stereotype really doesn't fit. I think it's. I was not offended by the film. I thought it was a great film, but people here are just like people everywhere else.
Time for a sequel, Courtney Johnson. What's the next thing to look for in the next 24 hours?
Well, we're maintaining vigilant. What the Red Cross is doing is we're continuing to feed all the folks that are up here helping out, the folks who are filling sandbags, the National Guard, the folks in our shelters, of course. And we are just on the lookout for an increase in shelter capacity, folks that if there are any more evacuations, we are ready and prepared to shelter them. And we're maintaining vigilant and just kind of keeping our eyes on the situation and really, really watching those levees.
So far, so good. And as your mayor says, uncharted territory there. The Red River is slowly coming down. Good luck, guys. Courtney Johnson is the Red Cross spokesperson in Fargo, North Dakota. Sarah Mayo, our friend, is a student at North Dakota University. And Richard Bailey is a doctor and Fargo resident. Thanks to all of them. And good luck to the people of Fargo. And now with more headlines, Mark Garrison is in.
Thank you. Coming up on 28 minutes after the hour. Coming up later this morning, President Obama is expected to announce he's giving GM and Chrysler a short time to submit better rebuilding plans. The Obama administration says neither automaker has made a case to justify more government bailout money. The president is reportedly setting a 60-day deadline for GM to come up with a new plan. Chrysler would get 30 days to seal an alliance with Italian carmaker Fiat. Dennis Virag is a Michigan auto consultant. He says a merger with Fiat could work for Chrysler.
Fiat has a fleet of very fuel-efficient vehicles, very attractive vehicles, product that Chrysler could really use in their product portfolio.
The White House has already forced out GM's chief executive, Rick Wagoner. Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm calls him a, quote, sacrificial lamb. She says he was working to turn GM around. In international news, a deadly hostage standoff in Pakistan is over. Police have arrested several gunmen at a police academy in Lahore, where they held dozens hostage. Other gunmen were killed in the gunfight. Several cops are known dead. Police are now sorting through the scene, so the final death toll could go higher. A leader of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia is being brought to justice today, some 30 years after the regime's atrocities. Gung Gek Yo, better known as Comrade Doik, ran a notorious prison camp. He's the first of five Khmer Rouge leaders to face trial. John.
It's an amazing sort of generational sort of calling to account of a horrible atrocity
back
in the
time.
1970s. Thank you, Mark Garrison.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. So GM's Rick Wagoner is out as the head of GM. Let's do a job interview, will you? Okay, so takeaway listener John, why do you think you'd like to run General Motors?
How would I save Detroit? I'd make a product people wanted to buy and not tell them what to buy. I'd listen to what they were saying and the rest of the world was saying and then create a product that everybody wanted. It's pretty simple.
Good answer. What would you invest in? What would you shutter if you were running General Motors? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. So I was in a hotel room in the Detroit area over the weekend, and I had kind of a poignant moment watching C-SPAN on the hotel television. You know, I'm such a wonk. But on Book TV, the C-SPAN channel, it was a whole John Hope Franklin weekend. There were remembrances of his book signings and interviews. The Duke historian even explained what it is that got him to be a historian. Here's an example.
This young white professor by the name of Theodore Currier was such a remarkable lecturer and he exuded excitement in a way that I did not know history could be. And, I decided that I'd better get a little more of him. And so I, in my second year in college, registered for an elective in history, and I could almost say the rest is history, but I won't say that.
But the rest is history. In many ways, John Hope Franklin is history. He was a historian. He was a civil rights leader. His book, From Slavery to Freedom, A History of African Americans, has sold more than 3 million copies. He died at the age of 94. Last week. But to talk about his legacy, we could really fill an entire program. But we have this morning Patrick Henry Bass, takeaway contributor and senior literary editor at Essence Magazine, here in the studio to talk about the loss, but really the legacy of such an important, influential figure. And, you know, in the pictures on Book TV over the weekend, you just saw these mobbed crowds of people talking to him, both about his life, about his view of history. And there you hear how he got into history. It was a white professor that caused him to think passionately about history. He was going to be a lawyer.
Right. Just like his father. It's good to be here with you, John. His father was a lawyer. His mother was an educator. This is a huge loss, and we're still feeling it in the African-American community, especially among the African-American black press. So you're going to start to see a lot of coverage of John Hope Franklin's life and his legacy since many of those publications publish on Thursday. He was the last of the great icons of the civil rights movement, and even further back than From Slavery to Freedom, we can't imagine African-American history without it or American history without it. We have to remember 1947, when the book was first published, we had Negro History Week. Thank God for Carter G. Woodson for giving us Negro History Week. And so what From Slavery to Freedom was able to do was to fill in the blanks on African-American history and also American history. The black press during its heyday, you know, the last great moment during the 19th century was the North Star, Frederick Douglass's paper, but there was a blackout between the Civil War and Reconstruction, and From Slavery to Freedom not only filled the gaps and filled the blanks and shed light on that very dark moment in our history, but also he took us back to 1617 and even further back.
Patrick, what was it about John Hope Franklin that allowed him to speak about the civil rights struggle, both in terms of the passion and the political outrage that came from the insults to the African-American community as a legacy of slavery and segregation and the Jim Crow laws? But he also was able to speak passionately and joyfully about the civil rights movement being a working out of the Constitution before his very eyes as a historian. He had both the joy and the outrage.
But there's no accident that his middle name was Hope. You know, he blended a great deal of idealism with realism as a historian. So he always believed in African-American ingenuity and creativity and intelligence.
And here is in his own words, him talking about how Americans really weren't as passionate about getting into their history as he was.
I think Americans have a way of shuffling off the things that seem to be unpleasant, and they therefore don't take a direct look at the serious questions like civil rights.
And when he speaks about that, he's talking not simply about, you know, what maybe Eric Holder was talking about when he described the lack of courage in Americans dealing with civil rights. He's also talking about, you know, what happened to him personally. As the president of the history department at Brooklyn College, he lived exactly what that is all about.
Not only that, John, remember when he got the Presidential Medal of Freedom, that day, someone mistook him for a driver. You know, like someone gave him the keys to their car after he went to the White House to get this, you know, amazing award from President Clinton for the highest civilian honor in the land. Someone also asked him to serve them that same evening.
You know, he has a great eye for detail, and he described another experience of racism in his 80s.
One of the last times I was in Oklahoma after I was in my 80s, I was ordered by a white man in the lobby of a hotel to take his bags up to his room. Why was I there if I was not there to wait on him and to serve him?
Now, that's John Hope Franklin speaking in 2005. A real eye for detail of both racism and the broad themes of American history.
Right. I encourage everyone to look at From Slavery to Freedom. It's now in its 8th edition from Knopf. It's the quintessential book of American history in terms of the African-American perspective.
Knopf asked him to write it, right?
That's exactly right. It's Alfred A. Knopf asked him to write it. It's painstakingly, incredibly well done, especially about, again, Reconstruction. The violence. A lot of people romanticize the South. You know, it wasn't like Showboat, but the darker aspects of our history, especially the violence and cruelty, has sort of been abated. And he gave that a new life through an incredible prism. If anybody wants to check him out, the National Visionary Leadership Directory, which is an organization that Camille Cosme and Renee Poussaint started, are launching a video of John Hope Franklin today on YouTube. You should check it out.
Oh, that's great. Well, we will leave you with John Hope Franklin talking about what he loved to do when he would take a break from his writing.
I take breaks. I go out to the greenhouse and I work for, let's say, an hour, maybe 2 hours. Then I take a break. I get up and walk around and... people have coffee breaks, and I have orchid breaks. I get up, I think about my orchids, and I go out there and stir around in the greenhouse for maybe 15 minutes or so, and then I come back and start working again.
A vision of peace from someone who maybe didn't have enough of it. John Hope Franklin, who died last week at the age of 94. Patrick Henry Bass, thanks so much for being a part of that segment. Patrick, of course, is Takeaway contributor and senior literary editor at Essence Magazine. And now some headlines from Mark Garrison. Mark?
Thank you, John. Coming up on 20 minutes before the hour, a winter storm is on the way to North Dakota. Residents, of course, are already dealing with a swollen Red River. A half foot of snow is expected, but that should not boost the water level. Cold temperatures mean the flakes should not melt into water, but strong winds, though, could cause waves on the river, sending water over the dike, so they're watching that. Extremists with ties to Al-Qaeda in the Philippines have set tomorrow as a deadline for beheading one of 3 Red Cross hostages. They say they will do that if police don't leave the jungle area where the group is holed up. John.
Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And today is the first day of a very long-awaited initial trial at Cambodia's Khmer Rouge Tribunal. Months of pretrial hearings, and the man best known as Comrade Doik faces charges of crimes against humanity over his role in the torture and murder of thousands of people back in the 1970s. Earlier this morning, I spoke with the BBC's Guy Delaunay in Phnom Penh. When we spoke, I asked Guy to explain the significance of this trial to the people of Cambodia.
It's not just that they've been waiting through months of pre-trial hearing. They've been waiting 30 years since the fall of the Khmer Rouge regime in 1979 to see anybody held to account for what happened in the 4 years of Khmer Rouge rule. Now, just to remind you, between 1975 and 1979, when the Khmer Rouge under Pol Pot were in power in Cambodia, around 1.7 million Cambodians died, not through natural causes, but because of Khmer Rouge policies, which included the forced evacuation of the city, 1960s, summary execution of anyone considered an enemy of the revolution, forced labor in the rice fields, and of course many people died of malnutrition because despite the fact that they were producing all this rice, they weren't given any of it to eat. Nobody's ever really been held to account for all this. So seeing Comrade Duyk in the dock, a very big step for Cambodians.
Now, unlike the situation in Rwanda, where the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, also in South Africa, where people were made to face their actual victims, the question really here is, he's facing the legend of Pol Pot, not necessarily Cambodians who actually were victims or who are related to victims from the Pol Pot regime. How does that make this different?
Well, it's actually got a bit of both elements. What we do have indeed, as you say, Duyk is probably the most notorious living Khmer Rouge figure simply because he was in charge of this prison called Tuol Sleng S21 in Phnom Penh, which has been turned into a genocide museum. Around 14,000 people were inmates in that prison. All but a handful of them died, either tortured to death or bludgeoned to death with blunt instruments in the so-called killing fields. Now, he wasn't a senior leader of the Khmer Rouge, but he's certainly an iconic figure for those people. But in fact, there is an interesting element, an intriguing element in this tribunal, which is different from other international criminal tribunals and more like the truth and reconciliation processes that you mentioned. There are actually civil parties to this case, and that means that people who feel they've been victims in a particular case, in this case the case of Comrade Duyk, can apply to be a participant in effect, and they get some speaking rights in court. They do get the right to, in some cases, I believe, address the victim, although of course that will actually address the accused rather, although that will be ruled on by the judges. So it's an interesting mix of things.
In terms of the international historical legacy here, is there a sense from the people of Cambodia that there is maybe an individual or a party missing from this trial, and that might be the U.S. complicity in Pol Pot actually taking power in Cambodia, or is that faded?
Well, that's an interesting aspect. You go around the country and there are still dozens, well, hundreds, thousands of craters from bombs dropped by B-52s and between 1969 and 1973. And those undoubtedly forced many people into the arms of the Khmer Rouge because they felt the Khmer Rouge would protect them better against the U.S. bombing at that time. I think people do still feel there are some unanswered questions from that time and would like to see foreigners in the dock. It's not going to happen, though.
A very interesting and historic trial. Comrade Duyk faces charges of crimes against humanity for his involvement in the Khmer Rouge period in Cambodia. My guest was Guy Delaunay, who spoke to us from Phnom Penh in an interview conducted earlier this morning.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, Wither Afghanistan, a look at a policy in transition. But first, headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, as early as Saturday, North Korea is expected to launch a missile to test its long-range weapons capability. Today, two U.S. destroyers capable of tracking and intercepting missiles are on their way to the region to look at the situation. South Korea is warning allies against a military response to the test, which North Korea claims is just a satellite launch. Syrian President Bashar Assad is urging Arab leaders meeting in Qatar to reject an international arrest warrant for Sudan's leader. The Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir is one of several heads of state at the Arab League's annual summit. The International Criminal Court has charged him with war crimes in Darfur. The World Bank predicts the Russian economy will shrink by 4.5% this year. Russia is particularly hard hit by low oil prices. World markets have been down, European Asian as well, and S&P futures point to a down opening on Wall Street next hour.
So thank you, Mark Garrison. So this morning on The Takeaway, a question. Where do we go from here? It's our week-long look at policies in transition with global implications. We're going to Afghanistan this morning. A look at that country and that region all week long. Joining us is Craig Mullaney, former captain of the U.S. Army in Afghanistan and a national security advisor during the Obama campaign. He's author of the book, The Unforgiving Minute, and he joins us from Washington, D.C. Craig Mullaney, thanks so much for coming on the program.
Good morning, John.
You know, as a West Pointer and someone who I think fairly represents the troops who will both be going over there as trainers and will be responsible for the tactics on the ground as well as implementing the policy in the broadest terms. Having Barack Obama on Friday with his entire security team outlining this new policy, is that a message for them as well as anyone else who might be concerned in the sort of diplomatic realm in South Asia?
I think it's clearly a message to the American troops, and the symbolism of having all these different elements of American government together in the room matters, because moving forward in Afghanistan, it has to be approached comprehensively and with a multi-pronged strategy that includes not just security, largely provided by the military, but also regional diplomatic outreach and sort of on-the-ground, muddy boots, diplomatic and civilian work.
Now, you know, during the campaign, Afghanistan, or beefing up our policy in Afghanistan, or shifting our focus back to Afghanistan, some of the language that was used during the campaign was a euphemism for getting Osama bin Laden. But that really wasn't what came out of the Friday briefing. What is the mission exactly?
Well, I mean, I don't think the campaign rhetoric was a guise for anything other than what it said, which was, I think, President Obama's sincere focus on making Afghanistan right. And the focus of the strategy is on disrupting, defeating, and dismantling al-Qaeda. But it recognizes that you can't get from here to there without sort of drying up the support for al-Qaeda and for extremism in parts of Afghanistan and also Pakistan threatened by the Taliban.
Now, the Pakistan policy and the references to Pakistan in the speech on Friday were many. And I'm wondering if it's fair to say that Pakistan is at the center of this policy, really. And if so, what are the quid pro quos? What are the levers to pull in Pakistan, the civilian government of which is at least as concerned about India as it is about the Taliban?
There's a few. I mean, one sort of going directly to the Pakistani people, and that's, I think, the signal of tripling non-military assistance to Pakistan over a five-year period is sending a very strong signal to the Pakistani people. One of the greatest success stories of the Bush administration was our response to the Kashmir earthquake in 2005. And for a relatively small investment, one-tenth of the investment in Pakistan's military capability, we doubled support for the United States within Pakistan.
Although, Craig, the other example there would be billions that went to fund the Mujahideen during the Reagan era when the fight was against the Soviets in Afghanistan, and that aid went to forces that ultimately were destabilizing.
No, you're absolutely right, and that's the challenge in working with the Pakistani military, elements of which have clearly not been supportive of American policy and in some cases stated Pakistani policy. And I think it's time now for the double game to stop. And you know the devil's in the details of how you do that, but I'd expect President Obama to not have a sort of a blank, he's not giving a blank check to the Pakistani government.
Well, he sort of referred to that specifically. Let's listen in Obama's own voice on Face the Nation yesterday.
We have to recognize that part of our task in working with Pakistan is not just military. It's also our capacity to build their capacity through civilian interventions, through development, through aid assistance. And that's part of what you're seeing both in Afghanistan and Pakistan, I think, is fully resourcing a comprehensive strategy that doesn't just rely on bullets or bombs, but also relies on agricultural specialists, on doctors, on engineers.
Craig Mullaney, it also relies on diplomats, and in some sense it relies on Iran, which may be a partner here, tacitly or otherwise. What is the likelihood of that partnership being as broad as Obama envisions?
I'm not sure what the extent of the relationship with Iran will be, but there's certainly a couple of key areas that you would want. You may look for cooperation. One is in the transit of logistical supplies into Afghanistan, given how much more difficult it's become to get supplies through through the Khyber Pass in Pakistan. And then the second area is Iran and Afghanistan share the threat of opium production. Iran does not want illegal narcotics transiting its territory, and there could be some very effective intelligence sharing of the kind that existed immediately after we invaded Afghanistan in 2001.
Craig, how confident are you, and of course with your eyes on the ground there, you understand the sort of nuances that separate the Taliban in Pakistan from the Taliban inside Afghanistan. Does the Obama administration have that clear in mind? And, you know, we should remind people that General Petraeus, of course, at the head of SEDCOM, is running the tactical operation here.
I'll say it can be very difficult on the ground to understand exactly who it is you're fighting, whether they're Afghani Taliban, Pakistani Taliban, or al-Qaeda. There's no distinguishing marks on the uniform. Our intelligence is still very grainy. And Admiral Blair, the Director of National Intelligence, said as much last week. But I think there may be some ways to cause some fractures in the alliance of convenience. And I think that's one of the things you'll look at, we'll be looking at.
When you say alliance of convenience, elaborate on that. What are you talking about?
Well, certain elements of this, say the Pakistani Taliban, and say they're focused on establishing sort of a zone of control within Pakistan that's not within the Pakistani state's power, where their focus might not be on the other side of the border in Afghanistan. And the Afghanistan Taliban, which doesn't particularly care about the government in Pakistan, but wants to reestablish the Islamic Emirate in Afghanistan that existed from 96 to 2001.
So the complicated set of sort of convenient relationships constitute something of a toe popper if you don't really know what you're doing as you get in there.
And there's more. I mean, there's the Haqqani network. There's Hekmatyar. There are a number of bad actors in that region.
Complexities radiating out from the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan, all complicating the question of where we go from here. We're going to pause there, but Craig Mullaney, thanks so much for joining us. Craig is a former captain in the U.S. Army in Afghanistan. He's a national security advisor for the Obama campaign and author of the extraordinary book, The Unforgiving Minute. So back here in the U.S., we're focused on Detroit, where today GM's Rick Wagoner steps down as the head of the troubled company as Obama rolls out its carmaker plans. Time for a job interview. If you had the GM job, how would you save the company?
Troy calling from quite flooded North Dakota. To get the GM job, I would pitch an electric-powered Corvette, thus pleasing both the aesthetics of the classic-era gearheads as well as the functional concerns of the eco-friendlies. Which probably wouldn't work, but if politicians can promise everything and deliver little, why can't car execs?
A Tesla for a new era. Thank you, Troy. What would you invest in? What would you shutter? What would you want? Would you even want the GM job to begin with? Some of our listeners in Detroit have some special insight of what to do with their hometown business. We haven't heard from any of you yet. Wherever you are, tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Probably most of those Michigan listeners are like thinking about Michigan State in the Final Four. Here's your takeaway.
This is going to be G20 week. This is going to be the big story of the week. But also what we're going to see here is kind of Barack Obama's popularity. He's more popular than all his other G20 heads of state versus America's lack of popularity.
That's Marcus Mabry from our partner, the New York Times, talking about the G20. It's a G20 week. We had a great interview with Marcus, so check it out on our podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. This, of course, is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
message to General Motors from Obama. Kind of a bring me the head of Kaiser Soze.
I work for Kaiser Soze.
It was Kaiser Soze.
I'm telling you, it's Kaiser Soze!
There is no Kaiser Soze.
He does not expect all of you to live, but those of you who do will have $91 million.
Actually, it's more like $21 billion, and GM's Kaiser Soze is CEO Rick Wagoner, who is suddenly out, getting beyond the usual suspects as Obama rolls out his plan to save the carmakers.
The only thing that scares me is Kaiser Soze.
Call it a fleeting moment of immortality for Rick Wagoner, courtesy of The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Yes, Virginia, there is no Kaiser Soze. Good morning. It's Monday, March 30th. Adora Udoji is away spending time with her new baby. And coming up this hour, we'll talk more about the president's plans for GM and Chrysler and look at the growing rift between a prominent Muslim American group and the FBI. We'll check in on the richest horse race in the world in Dubai and look ahead to this week's G20 meeting in London. Those stories and more coming up. But the headlines are right in Detroit. President Obama says GM and Chrysler have failed to make the changes necessary to survive. But the government will keep the companies on the road a little longer as long as they make even more changes.
That's going to mean a set of sacrifices from all parties involved. Management, labor, shareholders, creditors, suppliers, dealers.
GM CEO Rick Wagoner is apparently stepping down at the White House's request that gives the new leadership at GM 60 more days to get things in order. As for Chrysler, the White House says the company needs to get more global. It has 30 days to complete an alliance with Italian carmaker Fiat. Bankruptcy is still an option, and auto bailout critics like John McCain say that's exactly what should happen.
The auto industry ought to go into prepackaged bankruptcy, into Chapter 11, from which they can emerge, and they can emerge and be competitive.
President Obama will make his formal announcement about the automakers in just a couple of hours. Mark Garrison, what else is going on?
Good morning, John. In the northeastern Pakistani city of Lahore, paramilitary troops are celebrating the end of a 9-hour siege at a police academy. The number of people killed in the raid is still being verified. It could be as high as 40. According to the BBC, many militants were killed. The rest are under arrest. Officials in Carthage, North Carolina, now say the ex-wife of a man who killed 8 people over the weekend, police say, worked at the nursing home where the shootings took place. But they still don't know why the man went room to room, killing 7 patients and a nurse and injuring 3 others before he was shot and wounded. The weekend flooding in Fargo, North Dakota wasn't quite as bad as feared, but the Red River is still more than 20 feet over flood stage, and it's going to be a brutal day. A winter storm is expected to drop up to 0.5 foot of snow with 40-mile-an-hour winds today.
So snow is good news for the floodwaters, but the winds are not,
water.
That's for sure. Asian stock markets took a nosedive today. Japan's Nikkei and Hong Kong's Hang Seng were both down more than 4.5%. Volatility looks to continue on Wall Street, where the futures suggest a negative opening when Wall Street opens in about a half hour from now. Rick Wagoner is stepping down. Hey, why don't you take the helm at GM?
Paul from Rhode Island, take that sucker private. Get it out of the stock market.
If you were running GM, what would you invest in? What would you shutter? Would you even want this job? 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. More about General Motors and the automakers coming right up.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. People in Detroit know this, but General Motors, you may not know, is located in something called the Renaissance Center in Detroit. But Renaissance may not be the word that auto workers or Detroit residents are going to be using for the announcement from the Obama administration later on this morning. In a few hours, the Obama administration is set to unveil its restructuring plan for the troubled auto industry. We'll deal with GM and Chrysler. And apparently one of the conditions of this plan was the ouster of GM's chief executive, Rick Wagoner. We turn to our partners at the New York Times Times to elaborate on this story and to figure out what it exactly means. Micheline Maynard is the senior business correspondent for the New York Times. She joins us from Detroit. Cheryl Gay Stolberg, White House correspondent for the Times. She's in Washington. Micheline and Cheryl, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Thank you.
So, Mickey, in some sense, it's not a surprise that Wagoner leaves, but it is a surprise that he leaves this late in the game, it seems to me. What's the reaction?
Well, I think if he were going to leave, I guess these are the circumstances under which he would leave, because he had vowed not to take General Motors into Chapter 11, and the Obama administration seems to be hinting very strongly that that's where GM may end up. I think yesterday Detroit was very much in shock, and you have to remember that Michigan State had just won their NCAA game, and people were in the mood to celebrate that and turned around and saw that Rick Wagoner was out.
It seems, Cheryl, is there some sort of political dimension to Wagoner leaving in that they don't want this to end up with a AIG-like backstory about some executive somewhere getting a high salary or some kind of a bonus or some reward for bad behavior?
Well, I think obviously there's a public sensitivity to the sentiment that the government is pouring billions of dollars of taxpayer money into firms that haven't been run well, and the president himself has been saying this. He complained last week that the auto industry has engaged in mismanagement. So I think the feeling was that, as the White House officials say, they needed a clean sheet, but you might state it more simply that somebody's head had to roll.
Well, Cheryl, is this beginning to evolve into a kind of jobs program for Michigan that is a little bit independent of saving GM and Chrysler? We see in the Chrysler announcement that they either have to find a partner in Fiat or go away, it seems to me. That's the fine print here.
Well, I think the administration is rightly concerned that if these companies go under, the ripple effects will be vast. And so while the administration concluded that the companies are not currently viable, the president has decided he wants to step in anyway and give them a little bit more time to right themselves, because they do not want a chaotic, freewheeling bankruptcy where the companies collapse right away. So, this is also Wall Street versus Main Street, right? This is Main Street.
Now, we've been asking people all morning if they wanted to take the job at GM, what would they do? And one of our listeners called us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and said, what I'd do is fire all the UAW employees because they called this. They caused all of this problem. Micheline Maynard, what is the UAW's reaction to Wagoner's departure, and are they sort of standing alone now?
Well, as far as I know, they haven't reacted, and GM only confirmed it in the middle of the night. So I guess we'll be hearing more about that later today. The interesting thing about this is that Ford workers, and Ford is not asking for federal money, Ford workers have already given concessions to the company. We talked to one last week who said he estimates it's going to cost him about $12,000 this year in lost benefits. But the GM and Chrysler workers have never stepped up to give concessions because they were waiting for the bondholders to give concessions. And essentially the administration has said, you know, we want this done in 60 days at GM and 30 days at Chrysler, or we're not giving you any more money.
Now, let's just talk for 2 seconds from your perspective, Mickey, about Chrysler. There's no way the administration is going to bail out the private equity firm Cerberus that owns Chrysler, so it's Fiat or nothing, right?
Essentially, they gave them 30 days to conclude a deal with Fiat or another partner. Well, you're not going to have time in 30 days to find another partner. The only possibility might be General Motors if at some point somebody decides we're better off combining the two of them than propping up Chrysler.
Cheryl, is there any sort of talk, and this is kind of wildly speculative. I know you Times people don't like to be dragged into my sort of bizarre flights of fancy, and, you know, you can tell me to go away if you like. But I'm just wondering if there's some option here for a much broader nationalization of the car industry, because Barack Obama talks about fuel-efficient vehicles in America. Maybe General Motors isn't the company to get us to fuel-efficient electric vehicles, but some combination of Ford, GM, sort of high-techy divisions with everything else jettisoned might be. Is there any talk of something as broad as that?
I'm going to wave you away from the word nationalization, because I think the president and his aides have made very clear that what they want is a private auto industry that is streamlined and profitable. But I wouldn't wave you away from the idea that We could have fewer companies. The president is thinking very broadly about this, his advisors say. And I think in the administration's case, if that means fewer car companies making, you know, green vehicles and being more competitive and also being profitable, that's fine with them. They just want the industry on a long-term path to viability, and currently they don't see that.
Micheline, is there some way that the administration could possibly reconstitute a U.S. auto industry to make fuel-efficient cars using resources from GM, Chrysler, I don't know, maybe even you know, some of the workers who work for Toyota and Nissan?
No, I agree with Cheryl that I don't think we're going to see National Motors or anything like that, but what this president can do, and you know, may even do today or later on, later down the road, is say, I want vehicles to get X miles per gallon. I want them to hit these kinds of CO2 targets. You know, and I will give tax incentives to Americans to buy those kinds of cars. So he can reshape kind of the offerings that are on the road. Think about the EPA back in the 1970s. They said that we had to have fuel economy, and a lot of those big cars with fins, you know, and tailpipes went away. So a president can do a lot. We've never seen, you know, in my adult lifetime, we've never seen a president do this. But it's going to be very fascinating to watch.
So, Mickey, take a look at the Detroit Free Press this morning, if you can. Is the top headline the Michigan State making the Final Four, or is it Wagoner's ouster?
Well, I haven't seen it because this is the first day in Detroit that there's no home delivery.
Wow.
Yes, and what a terrible week to start that program. There's only going to be home delivery on 3 days. But on the web, you can bet that it's Rick Wagoner. Unfortunately, I think in any other circumstances, it would be Michigan State.
Well, that is such a, I mean, if that sentence right there doesn't typify what's going on in Detroit on so many levels, that's very, very memorable. Okay, so
believe me, John, yep. I would love this to be the day that I go outside and get those two newspaper bags and keep those newspapers, but I'm going to have to go driving around looking for the copies that they make available because my home delivery stopped on a daily basis yesterday.
Well, Cheryl Gay-Stolberg, let's talk about what this 11 o'clock briefing is going to look like. We saw when the president rolled out his Afghanistan policy last week that the entire national security team was arrayed behind him. It was certainly no Rumsfeld moment talking about foreign policy. Is it going to be a similar kind of tableau, do you think, at 11 o'clock when the president outlines the auto restructuring details?
You know, they haven't shared the details of their stagecraft with me, despite my trying to get it. But I wouldn't be surprised if he's flanked by his advisors, his economics advisors. I wouldn't be surprised if Larry Summers is there, but also Stephen Ratner and Ron Blum, the former investment bankers who have really become Barack Obama's car czars. And they've put a lot of work into examining the condition of these companies and assessing their viability and their were documents released by the White House late last night giving their conclusions. I think it will be a sober statement. It will be the president himself speaking. He goes off tomorrow to Europe and the G20, and already we're seeing concerns in the stock market about the viability of the auto industry and worries that the G20 won't be productive enough. So I think the president will use the full power of his platform to deliver this news in as positive a way as he can.
And before we leave, let's not forget, Cheryl, that you know, this is much closer to Barack Obama's heart. Even though Geithner and the banks and all the sort of AIG headlines have dominated for the last couple weeks, it's this auto restructuring that's really more where Obama's head and heart are, correct?
Well, I think so, because it involves American workers. And, you know, he's trying to be the president of the little guy. But as Micheline said, there needs to be concessions all the way around, and that's what he's making clear. So there needs to be concessions from big folks, big fat cats, you might say, and we've seen one very public one already, but there also need to be concessions from the unions.
And markets are looking for that sort of thing as well. The futures are way, way down this morning. Cheryl and Micheline, thanks so much. Micheline Maynard is the senior business correspondent, and Cheryl Gay-Stolberg, the White House correspondent for our partners, the New York Times, expecting a lower opening on Wall Street in the next few minutes. Yeah.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. A headless General Motors faces the music from Washington in about an hour and a half. If you were running the company, tell us, why do you want to run the ailing automaker?
Karen Kendrick Hands from Detroit, Michigan. I would take GM and Chrysler back to being transportation companies. The thing limiting building mass transit for our cities is a shortage of U.S.-based supply for transit vehicles. Let's let them build streetcars and high-speed rail vehicles and bring that big industry home.
Smart. A voice from Detroit. You call 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Your take on running General Motors. The job is available. So if you listened to this program last week, you discovered, as was reported in the New York Times, that the Justice Department is going to maintain its focus on counterterrorism. Eric Holder, the Attorney General, plans to make counterterrorism a central focus at both the FBI and the prosecutorial arm of the Justice Department itself. But this may be tougher than he thought, especially because of a story of a growing rift between the FBI and leaders of a prominent Muslim American group over allegations that the feds tried to infiltrate a mosque in Irvine, California, using a paid informant. For more on the details of this story and its important implications, I'm talking with Alexandra Marks, a senior writer for the Christian Science Monitor, who joins me here in the studio. Alex, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Now, this is a slightly difficult story to get all the details on, but explain how an apparently, possibly ham-handed impulse on the part of the FBI could create a rift that could have enormous implications for an organization trying to do counterterrorism investigative work with Muslim American groups.
Sure. I mean, the whole linchpin, particularly in the domestic anti-terror effort, is to have some kind of a good relationship with the Muslim American community. And there are two things that happened. One is that a gentleman went to a mosque in Irvine, California, said he was a new convert, but then started, you know, talking about jihad, raising all kinds of questions about, you know, the importance of violence, that kind of thing, which caused members of this mosque to go to CAIR, which is the Council on American Islamic Relations, report
C-A-I-R,
them.
C-A-I-R, right?
C-A-I-R, known as CAIR. And so what they did was they did the right thing. They reported to the FBI that they thought this guy was dangerous. They got a restraining order saying, please keep him away from, you know, our mosque because we think he's a jihadist and dangerous and potential terrorist. And the FBI then went and started investigating one of the men who informed or one of the men who reported this man. And basically reportedly said to him, if you don't inform for us, become an informant, we're going to make your life, quote unquote, a living hell.
Now, there's been enormous coverage of this story. And let's just get a sense of what the reaction has been in the Islamic press. And then I want you to come back and fill out more of the details. This is Mona Shadia, who's covering the story for In Focus News, which is the largest Muslim American newspaper in Southern California.
A lot of Muslims are really afraid that, you know, they get even approached by an FBI about anything. They're worried that they could be saying anything that could be taken out of context. They're just worried to speak freely.
Now, is that consistent, Alex, with your reporting? Muslims are suddenly worried to speak freely to the FBI, which is trying to create a liaison here.
I think there's a lot of uncomfort at this point. I don't know if I would say that they're actually worried to talk to the FBI. Both, you know, CARE and all the other leading Muslim American organizations have said, look, we will continue to work with the FBI on civil rights, any kind of legal issues. But we want an explanation. We want to be sure that you're not going into our mosques planting informants. Because it turned out, this is sort of the linchpin, it turned out that, you know, they eventually brought charges and arrested the man who had reported this potential terrorist. And it came out in the trial that this man who had come around and said he was a new informant was actually an ex-con FBI informant who was planted there. And that is, there's a sense that the FBI for 10 years since 9/11, the CARE and other Muslim American organizations have been working very closely to try to develop a healthy relationship. And so they just now, it's like they don't trust the FBI. Now, also because last summer, the FBI sent a little note out to all of the CARE offices. Now, CARE has 30 field offices in 19 different states, mm-hmm. and said basically, you know, sorry, we're going to suspend all formal relations with you. And it has to do with some distinct and narrow issues with your national office, but we're not going to tell you what they are.
Now we should remind people that CARE has a reputation for being, you know, slightly conservative and much more inclined to get involved in this sort of relationship with the FBI. So have they basically soiled the potential for working with an ally?
Well, that's what a lot of people think that the FBI has done. But there are some very conservative right-wing theorists who contend that CARE is nothing but a front for Hamas. And the reason that they say that is it goes back to the Holy Land Foundation trial. Mm-hmm. This gets really complicated.
Right,
but
right.
Bottom line, in the early 90s, before Hamas was designated as a terrorist organization by Clinton in 1995, some of the people involved with CARE were involved and had meetings with people connected with Hamas. So anyway, so what's going on now is some folks are saying, oh, you know, it's really clear that CARE is now this front organization. They've gone to Congress, who's put pressure on the FBI and said, oh, you know, you have to suspend relations. And so the FBI has. But the people at CARE say those are totally illegitimate charges. It's guilt by association, McCarthy-era tactics.
So where do we go from here quickly? Does Eric Holder have some fence mending to do? Does Barack Obama need to weigh in? Or is this something that will just sort of die down?
No, I think it's very important that Eric Holder do some fence mending. And, you know, Obama's got a lot on his plate, but he has said that reaching out to the Muslim community is very important, especially the Muslim American community.
Well, there you go. The story of an apparent rift between the FBI and CARE, one of the most important Muslim American organizations in the United States. It's a story in the Christian Science Monitor written by Alexandra Marks, who joined us here in the studio. Thank you, Alexandra. And Mark Garrison has more headlines.
Thank you, John. 28 minutes after the hour, Pakistani security forces have taken back a police academy in Lahore. Gunmen stormed the building and took hostages, sparking a deadly gun battle. Police say they have now captured or killed all of the militants. Authorities are still sorting through the scene to find out a total death toll that could number in the 40s. No militant group has taken responsibility for the attack. Victims of the Khmer Rouge regime in Cambodia packed a courtroom today. The first of five former leaders started his trial. It's been 30 years since the regime held power, committing widespread torture and murder. Gung Gek Yo, better known as Comrade Duik, ran a notorious prison. He expressed remorse for his actions. Police in North Carolina are looking into whether a gunman who went on a shooting spree at a nursing home yesterday targeted the facility because his ex-wife worked there. Police have Robert Stewart in custody. They say he killed 8. New information is said to be coming today. His motive still unclear. A government panel estimates 6% of American teens are clinically depressed. An even greater number may be undiagnosed. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force urges doctors to start depression screening for all teenage patients, even those without symptoms. John.
Thank you, Mark.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Our listeners are tapped into their rage against the four-wheeled machines. Rick Wagoner at GM is out of there as head of General Motors. So it's time for a job interview. If you were in his place, how would you save GM? And if you're like Pete, our listener, maybe it's trying to figure out what went wrong in the first place.
Two words, planned obsolescence. Whoever came up with that ruined me forever on Detroit. And I think that's kind of a mantra and the motto of the United States since Reagan.
So do a little job interview, will you? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You want to sit down at the CEO of General Motors? Tell us what you would do at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now, from the other side of the world, they're off.
They're racing in the Dubai World Cup, and well-armed won the start and won it clearly. Bounced more than a length in front. Muhanak, on the other hand, was last and immediately...
Did you know that the richest horse race in the world is the Dubai World Cup? It was run over the weekend. It's a $21 million series of races. The prize money in the race that you're hearing being called right there is worth $6 million to the winner, and the winner was Well-Armed, written by Aaron Grider, owned by Kentucky's Windstar Farm, a case of bluegrass on dry sand. But the horse race is just the beginning of a story of massive riches in Dubai, maybe getting downsizing in the realities of the economic crisis right now. Joining us is BBC Arabian Gulf correspondent Julia Wheeler from Dubai. Julia, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
So the horse race is both a chance for people of Dubai to kind of get away from it all and not think about some of the changes that are taking place there, and also to remind the rest of the world that the horse racing world is really centered in the Gulf right now, and that there are many frequent flyer miles of U.S. horses and U.S. trainers coming over there to race in the richest races in the world.
That's right, and that's been the case for the last 14 years. It was the 14th running on Saturday. It goes right back to 1996, when a very famous American horse, Cigar, took the first race and the prize money there. Again, as you say, won by an American horse this year, Well-Armed, who was third last year behind another horse that you may have heard of, Curlin. I believe that's one of yours as well.
Sure.
But this time it was Aaron Grider and Bill Kastner and his team who made history in two ways, actually. One, by Well-Armed being 14 lengths ahead of the second-placed horse. That's a race record. And you could hear there that he was first out of the starting gates and he stayed that way right away round to the finish. The second way that that horse made history was by winning the last ever race at the Nad Al Sheba racetrack in Dubai. Next year there's going to be a huge new grandstand where the race will take place. It's being built. It was only announced a couple of years ago, but it's sort of risen up out of the desert sands just a few hundred metres away from the existing track. It's called Maidan. It's going to be state-of-the-art. That's how it's being built. And it's expected to be able to hold about 60,000 people.
Now, you can almost hear the dollar trading up as the U.S. horse Well-Armed won the race. I'm just wondering if the financial context of all this building in Dubai for the races next year that you've described is, really a sense in Dubai that, you know, there's a limit suddenly on the horizon of what can be done, the investments that can be made, the Xanadu-like buildings that can be built.
Well, I think Maidan is probably the exception to that. But yes, Dubai is no different to anywhere else around the world, in the Middle East, in the United Arab Emirates. It is being affected. There was some denial from many people here in September, in October, even in November last year. And people were talking about Dubai being insulated from the world economy. But now they're being more honest with themselves and they're realizing that just because performance in the past has been so impressive, it doesn't guarantee future performance, as we all know. But the interesting thing here is that that has ramifications in different ways to other parts of the world, because 90 to 95% of the population of Dubai is expatriate or migrant workers. So if they lose their jobs, they effectively lose their right to live here. Obviously, that has a massive knock-on effect for the whole city in terms of real estate, in terms of schools, in terms of services and so on. So it is slightly different.
And, you know, as I've seen reports of really hundreds of thousands of people potentially cooling their heels in Dubai, and it's not cool there. And if they do return to their home countries, there's a whole issue of cash remittances that will have impacts from places like Bangladesh and Malaysia and Sri Lanka. How does that stand at this point? Is there a time clock ticking for those workers if they don't find jobs soon?
Yes, absolutely. If you lose your job, effectively you have 30 days before your visa expires, and you need to leave the country. Now, the federal government is looking into that and trying to extend it, because obviously 30 days isn't very long at all in order to find a new job, get yourself ensconced, and it's a fairly hair-raising situation. In terms of the remittances, ironically, within the last 6 months or so, with the rise in the dollar, it has been better for people who are sending money back from here, migrant workers who are sending money back from here, because the United Arab Emirates dirham is pegged to the dollar. So they've been better off in the last 6 months, and potentially could be in the next 6 months if they can keep their jobs. But there is less of a guarantee of that.
Now, Julie Wheeler, Dubai has always fancied itself a financial center of the region, since it doesn't really have its own oil, even though it relies on oil wealth, and sovereign funds from Abu Dhabi have helped to bail out Dubai at this point. Has the whole notion of Dubai as a financial center been shown to be a bit absurd at this point?
That's certainly not what the government is saying. No, I think it still believes in the Dubai International Financial Centre. It still hopes that it can fill that gap between East and West. There are more people out here looking for jobs, certainly talking to recruitment agencies and so on the phone from perhaps London and New York than there were 6 to 8 months ago. So what those people are saying, of course, is that there's the potential, if people are still able to offer jobs here, to get even better talent. I think that the hopes in terms of the financial side of things are still strong for the government, from the government point of view.
Hope and a very rich horse race. We talked with the BBC Persian Gulf correspondent Julia Wheeler from Dubai. Julia reported on the Dubai World Cup, the richest horse race in the world. Well-armed, an American horse won that race over the weekend. What's not doing so well is General Motors and its head, Rick Wagoner, who's stepping down as the head of the troubled company. If you had the job, how would you save GM? Tell us at 877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Mark Garrison has some headlines now.
Thank you, John. Coming up on 21 minutes before the hour, you've talked about the troubles of GM. Also, Chrysler, the president, later today will deliver a sharp message to both of them, expected to give them a tight deadline to come up with better plans. He shared his vision on CBS to what a better American auto industry could look like.
It's got to be one that's realistically designed to weather this storm and to emerge at the other end much more lean, mean, and competitive than it currently is.
In international news, North Korea is expected to launch a missile to test its long-range weapons capability as early as Saturday. South Korea is warning allies against any military response, worrying that a harsh reaction could provoke North Korea. In Africa, a number of soccer fans in Ivory Coast are dead today. This after a stampede frenzy took place over the weekend at a World Cup qualifying match. Also staying in Africa, Madonna was in a Malawi court today. She's attempting to adopt a second child from there. She also has a 3-year-old son, David, from the same country.
Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and we're taking a listen to voices around the country who are responding to Rick Wagoner, who is out as the head of General Motors. It's just one detail in a whole set of details that we're going to learn about probably a little over an hour from now, as the Barack Obama administration outlines its plans for General Motors and Chrysler. And here's one of the voices of our listeners who might take over from Rick Wagoner if the job was available.
Hi, this is Chris from Detroit. If I was in charge of GM, first thing I'd do is bring back all the jobs that GM outsourced to Mexico and other countries. I'd also hand over 3 slots on the boards of GM and Chrysler permanently to UAW members. And finally, I'd stop designing cars that look like ugly teardrops.
Our listeners have thought this through, like Bill from Sterling Heights, Michigan.
I'd have to find a way to get people to actually see reality. We do build cars that people want. Over 40% of car purchasers buy American cars. But do most people see that? No. They come in with preconceived notions. So if I were the new chairperson of GM, I'd have to find a way to get people to listen to me.
Interesting challenges. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. In the next few minutes, so we want to get a reaction from a good friend of ours, Will Markham, a UAW auto worker who's been reacting to all of this, looking at the headlines, seeing the front page of the web version of the Detroit Free Press this morning, talking about Rick Wagoner's departure. Will, what do you make of Wagoner's departure and what we're likely to see from the Obama administration in the next hour and 15 minutes or so?
Well, first of all, I want to say hi, John. Good talking to you again.
Great talking to you.
Well, there's a lot of mixed emotion here, you know. I mean, there's those who feel it's unfair that Rick's being picked on versus some of the other stuff we've seen in the news. You know, quite frankly, everybody's upset about their taxpayer money being used in ways that we're not sure we're going to get a return from. I guess if this is a long line of Rick's the first of CEOs, and you see stuff start happening at AIG and things of that nature, and they're all going to have to step up and pay the piper, then so be it. You know, I'm a believer that it's really the management of this country that's put us where we're at, not necessarily the workforce.
Well, Will, depending on how this works politically, with Rick Wagoner out, it seems like the last man standing here is the UAW, as at least some in Washington believe is the culprit and the institution that's going to have to deliver more concessions for GM to keep going. Does Rick Wagoner's departure mean there's less cover for the UAW?
I'm not really sure. You know, the politics of this country, we have our politicians in Washington, D.C., just the same as the corporations do. So, you know, I don't think Rick is a central point to that argument. I just, you know, I personally think it's a little unfair. I think at the end of the day, when we look at his whole career, there has been a lot of great products. Quality is a lot better, just like the one listener said. If people would go out and check American-made products, I think they'll be just shocked with the type of products, the gas mileage, and what's really out there. I mean, we get a lot of bad media, just the same way that, you know, I'm supposedly making $73 an hour, which, you know, that's a farce.
Well, Will, thanks so much for being a part of the program. We'll check with you later in the week, as again, Will Markham, UAW auto worker from Pontiac, Michigan, one of the people reacting to the departure of Rick Wagoner at General Motors.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. What does the G stand for in G20? We'll find out when we come back after headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, an Army court has found an American soldier guilty of killing four Iraqi detainees in 2007, playing a role in that. Sergeant First Class Joseph Mayo pleaded guilty today to murder and conspiracy. The detainees were bound and blindfolded and shot execution style. Mayo will be sentenced later today. He faces life in prison. In Lahore, Pakistan, officials say security forces have recaptured a police academy where a 9-hour siege took place. Gunmen stormed the building and took hostages. Officials say they've now captured or killed all of the militants. The Arab League's annual summit is going on in Qatar. Notably absent is Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. People say there's an Egypt-Qatar rift, and that's related to Iran's presence at the summit. Healing splits over Iran was already one of the top items on the summit agenda. Iranians trace their heritage to Persia, so many Arabs say they don't belong at an Arab League meeting. Moving to sports, in the NCAA men's basketball tournament, amid the auto industry troubles, something for Michigan residents to be happy about. Michigan State is going to the Final Four. They'll play Connecticut Saturday. Also, Villanova plays North Carolina. The women's field is at 8 right now, but games tonight and tomorrow will narrow the field to 4. John.
And the market, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, bouncing off an early bottom, down more than 1% as the markets react on Wall Street to the auto industry bailout. So GM head Rick Wagoner is stepping down as the head of that troubled company. Why don't you take the job?
I would change the compensation package so that no one made a base pay greater than $100,000 per year, and that anything over that would be based upon bonuses, based on profitability, which would be distributed to both line workers and administrators.
I'm amazed at how much our listeners have thought this through. 877-8-MY-TAKE and mytake@thetakeaway.org. Why should I be amazed? I don't know. Tell us your take if you want to run General Motors. So this week we see that the G20 meeting begins in London. It's dedicated to shoring up the global financial crisis. Is it going to be a strategy session or more like target practice for protesters who are angry at the G20 for blame for the financial crisis around the world? Joining us is Dan Price, who was the White House official responsible for the preparation for the last G20 summit, which was held in Washington, D.C. last November. Certainly the world has changed since then. He's currently a partner at Sydney Austin, a law firm. He joins us from London. Dan Price, what would be your briefing for preparing the G20 summit now? It's some months after November, but really the same urgent issues are on the table. If anything, things have gotten worse.
Good morning, John. I think that's right. When the G20 leaders last gathered in November in Washington, they were facing principally a financial market crisis. Since that time, events have, in the global economy, taken a turn for the worse. So when G20 leaders gather this time, they'll be addressing not only financial market stabilization, but efforts to put the global economy back on a path to growth and prosperity. It's really shaping up to be quite an important meeting. As you know, the G20 represents approximately 90% of global GDP, and they're going to be tackling these important issues, and they'll need to do so in a cooperative and a coordinated way that does not result in each country simply going it alone or lapsing into protectionism as each country seeks to pull its own economy out of recession.
So do we see sort of tensions within the G20 where Brazil and India are going to try to stake out some territory and maybe the U.S. and China will be on the other side, or is it the U.S. and the Eurozone? How are the politics going to shape up? And in some ways, it might be bad for them to have too much consensus because the world is really looking for a shakeup here.
Well, I think there is, in fact, an emerging consensus, and I think that's all to the good. We are facing a common set of problems in financial market stabilization and in getting the global economy back on track, and it's going to be important for the G20 all to be pulling in the same direction, and the early signs are that they are, in fact, doing that. There is an emerging consensus around the need to take stock and perhaps additional commitments in respect of domestic stimulus, to stabilize financial markets through shoring up financial institutions and dealing with impaired assets, through carrying forward a regulatory agenda to deal with systemically important institutions, through enhancing the resources of the IMF so that they can deal with the problems in the developing world, and through the importance of pushing back against protectionism so that each country does not pursue beggar-thy-neighbor policies or put up trade barriers as it begins the path of economic recovery.
Well, let's talk about the IMF there you just mentioned. I mean, it seems as though Brazil and India, at the very least, are going to be pushing for a much greater role in how the IMF and the World Bank operate.
Well, I think that's right, and I think that's appropriate. I think that the G20 leaders will probably reach some agreement on the need to reform governance of the IMF to give the emerging economies a greater voice in the governance of those institutions. Of course, with that greater voice comes greater responsibilities and greater financial commitment.
So explain to me what the role of China is here. I mean, first of all, communist countries, so the extent to which their economy is like the Europeans and the Indians and the Brazilians and the Americans is, you know, it's a little apples and oranges here. Nevertheless, does China vote with the Brazils and the Indias of the world, or do they sort of stick with the Europeans and the Americans, or do they go it alone?
It's not really a question of voting, John. I think if you look back at the November declaration at the Washington summit, you will see China and the other developing countries joining the broad consensus that we will only make our way out of this crisis if we embrace market principles and If we begin the process of regulatory reform in a cooperative fashion where we are not adopting conflicting regulations. So it's, again, it's not a question of countries voting. I think it's a question, as the G20 comes together, of finding consensus, and I think that can be found, and of demonstrating collective political will to right the global economy and make the changes necessary in our financial markets to restart commercial lending and return us to a path of prosperity.
So is there consensus that the dollar is the reserve currency going forward, or do we go with the sort of Chinese suggestion that maybe we need something else?
Certainly we've seen some back and forth in the press about the views of China and Russia about a reserve currency. You know, I would simply note that China has enormous dollar-denominated holdings, and the use of the dollar as a reserve currency will continue to be driven by the fundamentals of the U.S. economy. I believe the U.S. economy will remain a very strong one and an excellent place to invest, and that in the end will determine the future of the dollar as a global reserve currency.
Right, but let's go back to that question. I mean, if the Chinese want to hedge their bets and come up with some sort of alternative, even 5 years out, that would have enormous implications. The markets are incredibly volatile this morning. They're going to be watching not simply the statements, but the punctuation.
Right, and I think you're right. But what we need to keep our eye on is what are countries in fact doing, as opposed to political statements they may be making in the run-up to a leaders meeting.
So is what comes out of this going to be posturing, or is it going to be more a reflection of what these G20 countries are going to actually be doing?
I would certainly hope the latter, and I'm optimistic that they are on a path to have a very successful summit that will, you know, meet the objectives in those areas I outlined on financial market stabilization, regulatory reform, IMF reform, pushing back on protectionism, and committing to do what's necessary to restart the global economy.
So outside the ceremonies, those protesters are going to be storming the barricades all week, so to speak. The placards say it all. World will be watching. My guest, Dan Price, was the White House official responsible for the preparation of the last G20 summit held in Washington, D.C., the current summit getting started in London this week. Thanks to Dan. GM's Rick Wagoner is riding off into the sunset, you may have heard. Here's your takeaway.
The feeling was that, as the White House officials say, they needed a clean sheet, but you might state it more simply that somebody's head had to roll.
The head was Rick Wagoner. Cheryl Gay Stolberg, White House correspondent from our partner, The New York Times. So, all right, Rick Wagoner is out. Bill from Sterling Heights wants the job.
I'd have to find a way to get people to actually see reality. We do build cars that people want. Over 40% of car purchasers buy American cars. But do most people see that? No. They come in with preconceived notions. So if I were the new chairperson of GM, I'd have to find a way to get people to listen to me.
Or here's a twittering idea from Chris.
My plan would be change its name to Twitter and hope I could trick someone into buying it for $100 million.
Twitter. I'm sure there's a sucker out there who'd believe your Twitter. Tell us your take at our website, thetakeaway.org. And if you missed anything like that talk with Cheryl and the Times' Mickey Maynard, take our podcast to go. I'm John Hockenberry. Good Monday to you. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.